There's no better time to become a member of the DSR network. Later this month, we'll be announcing a major media partnership to our ever-expanding lineup of podcasts, bringing you even more insight and analysis than ever before. Members enjoy an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to the member-only Slack community, an evening newsletter recapping the day's top stories, and more. Best of all, if you become a member in the month of October, you can take 50% off the membership price for the first month. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code SPOOKY at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code SPOOKY. Thank you very much for your support.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. It's that time of the week when we discuss some of the most unsettling and big issues that we face in the world, the issues that have to do with national security and weapons technologies. It's the show we like to call We're All Gonna Die Radio. I am your co-host for the show, David Rothkopf, but I was not party to today's interesting conversation, which was a one-on-one hosted by John Wolfstall. So I'll turn it over to John to take you for the rest of the show.
So I am more than thrilled to be joined by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi. Rafael has been leading the organization for the last 4 years and was recently reelected to another four-year term. And to celebrate this important milestone, he's decided to join our little podcast, which, as you know, is called We're All Gonna Die Radio. So, Mr. Attorney General, let me say thank you and congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. Celebrating having a good chat with an old friend is a very good idea for me. So it's great to be joining you in this new endeavor. I think the themes on which you have been working officially for your country, for the United States, and I as an international official now for some years are very important, and I'm glad to be having this opportunity. So let's start. Yeah,
that's great, sir. And you know, a lot of people when we first launched the podcast were a little put off by the title because, of course, nobody wants to sign up to a podcast that's all doom and gloom. But you know, as well as anybody else in this community, we deal all the time with dangerous, challenging, complicated issues, and the challenges for human beings to figure out how we survive, how we work with this technology, which is not going to go away. And also, most people don't realize one of the two core missions for the Atomic Energy Agency is not just how to safeguard nuclear technology and prevent weaponization outside of authorized purposes, but also to promote the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And so I really want to start off there. You've just completed the annual general conference, and I want to give you a chance to tell us how things went. And then I have some specific questions about key issues, but really, how is the agency and how are you set up for managing these two issues of both safeguards and nuclear technology promotion?
Well, yeah, it's a very interesting moment in the curve, in the general evolution of things, if you want, on every side of the business. You refer to the typical or I would say the areas where or for which the agency is mostly known, the non-proliferation work, the safeguards, and with it come immediately to mind what happens in Iran or what may be happening in the DPRK in North Korea or in other places. But of course, there is the other side of it, which, as you rightly mentioned, and quite clearly, here is where the agency is called to play a role, hopefully a positive role, in what appears to be a regain, quite clear regain of interest on nuclear energy because of the convergence of problems of a global scale, like the common thread that we have in the global warming and the climate change problematic writ large, on the one hand, where nuclear energy, of course, as a CO2 free source of energy, is seen as part of the solution to the big dilemma we have as an international family, and concurrently with this, what has been called the energy security crisis, which has a double, I would say, source. One being what I just mentioned, the fact that countries need to decarbonize, countries need to find good alternatives for their current fossil fuel-based economies, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the black swan of the war in Ukraine that has created an anxiety, and rightly so, in many countries, in particular in this continent of Europe, where many countries, in particular in the central and eastern side of Europe, were heavily dependent on Russian gas. And all of a sudden, they have to rethink their energy mixes for political or technical reasons, or both of them. And many of these countries, most of these countries, have, of course, quite quickly come to the conclusion that doubling down on nuclear, which for most of the countries, with the exception of Poland, they are already using, Czechia, Hungary, Slovakia, Slovenia, Romania, Bulgaria, all of them are benefiting from nuclear, and now they're going for more. And Poland, which is one of the biggest European countries, but the only one that did not have nuclear energy, now is moving on with a very ambitious program. So this means that for the agency, this side of its business is growing considerably. To that, let me add to the pot the issue of new nuclear modularity, micro reactors, and the growing interest and legitimate interest, I would say, from many developing countries that see finally a nuclear option, nuclear option, I want to say, emphasize, that is affordable and probably feasible. When you talk to a middle-sized African nation, and I'm talking to several of them, the idea of going down the route of big nuclear power plants running costs in the billion zone would be a very complicated, if not impossible, way forward. But now, with the advent and the real possibility of having smaller units that respond to a completely different business model than the nuclear we have, then the discussion is different. And the IEA has a key role in inducting these countries in a safe, secure, non-proliferation way into this possibility. So, John, as you can see, this has become a portfolio that became from warm now to hot after many years of being dormant, if not completely in the defensive or really looking at the most of continuing what we had in nuclear and working on the commissioning. Now the story has changed completely, radically. And this is, of course, very, very important. To that, and I perhaps should stop to see your comments and how you want to steer our conversation, but to that, I would argue the new safety challenges that we have because of the war and other things happening in other parts of the world.
Director General, what we really need is a nice long dinner at some point when you're coming through Washington. Yeah. This could take hours and hours. We have a short period of time, but I do want to dive in. The future of nuclear power was part of my question set. But before we get there, you became known around the world as opposed to just to nuclear geeks like me because of the bravery that the inspectors and you personally demonstrated in the very dangerous, very complicated situation at Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. I know people will be focused on what is the latest status and just your assessment of really how dangerous is the situation. I mean, I wrote a piece for my own Substack saying it's a really, really bad idea to shell nuclear power plants. That's my technical evaluation. But you've been on the ground there really in the war zone. What's your assessment of the situation there and have things improved at all? Or are we still in a difficult situation?
Well, we go day by day. You know, this is a war, a real war. Very, very terrible war. And Zaporizhzhia happens to be sitting on the front line, not near the front line, not in the vicinity, it's on the front line. So that makes the situation absolutely dramatic, which means that we are constantly on the alert. So this is what prevents me from saying things have improved. I think what we are doing there is managing day by day, and each day brings something new. We do, of course, look. Perhaps for the audience, I should. Mentioned that I have been looking basically, of course, at the safety functions and security aspects, but also after my visit to the and my address to the United Nations Security Council earlier this year, I established a few basic principles which you more or less refer to in your comment, which basically boil down to please don't shoot at a nuclear power plant, or seeing more from the Russian perspective, don't militarize a nuclear power plant. Don't use it as a base to project force to the other side because of the potential consequences that this might bring. So we are now looking at the whole spectrum. ISAMS, which is the IAEA support and assistance mission in Zaporizhzhia, ISAMS, is looking at everything. So we are looking at the functioning of the station. And at the same time, we are looking at the military aspects related to the plant and the plant site. So this allows us and has given us additional authorities, if I may put it like that, to be looking into things like the absence of heavy military equipment, rocket launchers, tanks. Things like this, and it's mind-boggling, isn't it? So, but this is what we are confronted with. This is one thing, and the other, as you know, and this can change any time, because you know one thing that happens to me when I visit and when I talk to our inspectors there is that the background noise of the conversation is artillery. And I mean it. So it's quite, emotionally strong to be talking to somebody and hear boom, boom in the background, you know. It's quite terrible, really, because of the war and the suffering, first of all, and let's put first things first, and that the tragedy that this has brought upon Ukraine. But thinking about the consequences of any of this, wittingly or unwittingly, affecting the plant. To add to this, the consequences of the interruptions in the outside power to the station, which could even more than direct kinetic attack affect the cooling function of the plant, leading to some accident with a radiological consequence, as you know very well. So this is one aspect that we are looking at. To add to the easy job, back in June, the huge Nova Kharkovka dam down the river, Dnieper, was blown up, completely altering the hydraulic balance of the plant and its ability to get the water it needs to be cooled. So we had to also open a specific dialogue, work and support on this matter. So as I'm telling you, you know, I'm like those prisoners marking on the wall a day that passes without having a nuclear accident. So I'm not able to say things have improved. There is a relative, I would say, but I don't want to take credit for things that, may change overnight. I would say that the presence, let me put it like that, the presence of ISAMs, the almost daily reporting that we do, the interactions that we have with the Russians and, of course, with the owners of the plant, with the Ukrainians, have led to a situation where I want to think that we are playing a deterrent role of sorts. If anything, because of the fact that we are going to be telling the world what is happening, and that I myself would jump on a vehicle and be there like we did last September if something happens. So I believe that we have made the stakes a bit higher for those who might have. I don't want to exaggerate the role that we are playing there, but it's certainly better to have us there than not, I believe.
You're being modest, both personally and I know you will support wanting to point out that these volunteers, inspectors yeah. at the plant, yeah. My family ran away from Ukraine generations ago.
Yeah.
That there are engineers and scientists and health physicists yeah. that are running to the war zone that they are the ones both ensuring that the plant is safe, has what it needs, and as you said, I think serving as a deterrent is simply remarkable.
Totally, John. Let me say something here because, I think we have to say it, and people need to know this. When we talk about working in these very difficult conditions, and we think about our law enforcement agents or the firemen or even people in the armed forces, and we extol their sacrifice. But frankly, this is what they signed up for. A person coming to work for the IAEA in the Department of Nuclear Safety was certainly not thinking about a war when they joined. And I must say, and this is so moving, that I never, we are now at the 11th ISAMS team, 10th. 10 rotations. I never had a problem in filling up the lists of the of those who wanted to be there. And not only that, think about Christmas, think about New Year, think about Rosh Hashanah, think about Eid, think about whatever. And they don't care. They just go. They want to be part of it. They want to go and help. And they know, of course, we succeed in completing the rotations, but each rotation, John, is an agony because we have to do the deconflicting. I've done three myself, including the first one. And well, you know how this is. You are going through a war zone. You are crossing a front line. You are sometimes getting in so-called gray zones where nobody takes responsibility for what may be happening there. So you have to negotiate a silence, which means that they are not going to be shooting at you, basically, all right, with both sides. It gives you the goosebumps. I've been in places walking and I see the soldiers on the one side with their flag and looking at the other side where the other guys have their own flag. And they are looking at each other. And we have the team of the IEA crossing minefields, and I'm not exaggerating, with their backpacks and their documents and their laptops and whatever. So I want to, you know, really pay homage because they vindicate the dream of multilateralism. They are what you have in mind when you have to explain to your son or your daughter what an international civil servant is or is supposed to be. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to say that because they are really proving that it is not true that it's always a useless thing to have international organizations. I think we are filling a space. We are trying to do it. I don't know whether we are going to succeed, and I hope never to be able to say that we have something to regret. But this is the situation. And I also need to say that member states, countries, and the United States has been incredibly generous. They are giving us the funds to do it because this, as you can imagine, this was never budgeted. You know, I didn't have in my program a budget war in Ukraine item.
Right.
No, I didn't.
Poor, yeah. Poor planning on your part, Rafael.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Risk assessment. They are, you know, giving us everything we need. At this point, you know something? These rotations that we are doing, the IEA has been pushed into transforming itself into an on-the-field agency. In the beginning, we had the United Nations with us, doing the, you know, giving us the vehicles, giving us the, you know, the experts that do the conflicting. But our mission has become so intense and so intensive that we were sucking up the air in the room, and we were told that we would have to do it on our own. So now I have my own armored vehicles, unthinkable, my own armored vehicles, personnel specially trained for that. We are doing the conflicting for the passage each time that we go. So I think this has been, I suppose, it's quite obvious, isn't it? Wars are transformational events, not always for the better. But let's admit that when we look at contemporary history, we will see that it's unfortunately the conflict that leads to transformations. Some are good, some are bad. What we are trying to do is to rise up to the challenge in front of us.
So I joked with you last year that I was writing a script where the IAEA would be defending the ZNPP, and at the end of the movie, Antonio Banderas would play you in the, would be on top of it with an anti-aircraft missile. You've talked yourself out of the role. I'm going to find some brave nuclear engineer from the Office of Safeguards or Office of Safety and make them the star. So you're off the hook, and you'll have to tell your wife why you're not going to the premiere. But I'm glad you had the chance to footstop right. this, sir, because it is incredible. Yeah. Let me ask you, I know we're going to run short on time because there's so much to talk about.
Yeah.
One thing that is not in the news, and it amazes me, because I know you spend a lot of time on it and the agency spends a lot of time on it. But in the United States, Iran is not talked about on a regular basis. We just had a hostage release, which of course was important to bring Americans home. And there's still other hostages being held in Iran. But their nuclear program continues to grow. And I know that you have been intensely involved in talking with Iranians about cooperation, about their past program, transparency on their current program. What can you tell us about where things stand in Iran today?
Well, you're spot on. Spot on there in terms of the quite curious or interesting decrease in the attention, in international attention on what is going on there. Because fundamentally, nothing has changed, or I would even say, in a certain sense, we are not making any progress on this issue. Perhaps there is a fatigue on an issue that has been ongoing for 20 years or more, and so people are looking elsewhere. The fact of the matter is that we still have important things that have not been clarified. We also have a very curious situation of the JCPOA being, you know, by all means and purposes dead, but of course no one pronouncing it dead. Perhaps, you know, with an electroshock, it could be revived. And this is, and
it's
this
like a zombie JCPOA might come back. Yeah, right.
Something. And people still talk about it. And I think it's good that they talk about it as a possible, maybe, goal or, you know, objective, to go, towards, although it would be more symbolic than anything else, because the Iran's program has grown, has spawned, actually, in such a way that JCPOA provisions look, you know, pale and modest if you compare with the kind of activity, and I'm being neutral here in the description, the kind of activity that you should be looking at. You are looking now at modern centrifuges, at completely different, of course, the 60% enrichment and many more facilities there. So at the very least, you could have JCPOA, you know, rebooted, reloaded, or point two, or however you wish to call it. But, you know, the IAEA is basically a space of dialogue, diplomacy, constructive technical work. So we are always there trying to open doors in a realistic way, of course, so that this trust can be rebuilt. At the moment, we don't see that. I think all players, including Iran, realize that. And this is why we are in this sort of paralysis. But I can tell you that the paralysis does not affect the centrifuges that are spinning. They are not paralyzed at all. So the only thing that is paralyzed is the diplomatic work and the technical work that should be making sure, you know, as someone said, in your country, we trust, but we verify. So I trust everybody. I trust the Iranians when they tell me that everything is okay. But let me go and check that this is the case, and we will all be happier, I guess. And the confidence will be there, and all sorts of good things and sanctions relief and the whole, you know, package will come. But we are not there. We are not there yet. What we are trying, we have a presence. We should not mislead your listeners. We are there. It's not that we disappeared from Iran, but quite clearly the visibility, the inspection scope that we have is not commensurate with a program of this kind of ambition.
So I think you put your finger on a really important question, Mr. Director General. The goal of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was to ensure the United States, not the International Atomic Energy, but the United States and the partners, would have a good long one-year lead time if Iran were to make a decision that it wanted to weaponize. The International Atomic Energy Agency is built around providing timely notice if a country decides to divert materials. Do you still have confidence that given the transparency and the presence that the IAEA can provide timely warning and timely notice if Iran were to make a move to weaponize what its capabilities are?
I think we do. I think we do, but there are many problematic areas. There are many problematic areas because we have lost all visibility in areas which are key, like centrifuge component production facilities and things like this, which are structural. Because if you look at if you're looking at material balance and inventory of enriched uranium, well, yes, this could be negotiated away and shipped out of the country, but you still have a huge production capability about which I'm about to lose, really, the ability to certify anything. What I'm telling, and I'm telling you this in this way, and I say it in the same way to my Iranian counterparts. So here I'm not, you know, catering to an American audience or a Western audience. I was talking to the president of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran the other day, and I was telling him the same. I mean, you're talking about coming back to the JCPOA, but let me tell you that it's me that will have to be signing on the dotted line of your baseline. And I will not be able to do that if I am not aware of what you may have somewhere in the country, and that would be allowing you, given the accuracy and the reliability of the new model centrifuges, would be, you know, giving the country the ability to reconstruct very, very quickly a stock pile of enriched uranium very, very fast. So I think it's a, for me, it's a no-brainer if we mean what we say, if they mean what they say.
So we're going to come to a close in a minute, Mr. General. You've been extremely generous with your time. I'm going to let our listeners in on the game us nuclear people play. You've already laid down a couple of very ominous and serious issues in Ukraine, in Zaporizhia, in Iran. But of course, the ultimate game is what keeps you up at night. What are we not talking about that you are worried about that we need to understand more? There, I know that there are tremendous drains on resources at the IAEA. You look at Iran and Ukraine and North Korea and South Asia and nuclear security, which I know is a growing role in the IAEA. But what do you want me and what do you want us to be aware of that we're probably not talking about?
70% of Africans do not have access to radiotherapy. I've launched an international program that is called Rays of Hope. And I'm fighting very, very hard to bring cancer medicine to Africa and to other parts of the world. I think many of the problems, instabilities, tensions that we have in Europe and in other parts, given the migration crisis, which have very important security connotations, have to do with these inequalities. And of course, these issues, Zaporizhia, Iran and North Korea, and of course, what happens in the Indo-Pacific, which we haven't had the time to discuss, are issues of enormous preoccupation for me. But I believe that this incredible instrument that I have, which is the IAEA, can have the ability to improve the lives of millions that are dying of things that no one in America dies anymore. So this is a pending debt that we have. And I'm sorry if I deviate a little bit of our hard agenda that we have, if I mention these things, because, I mean, we started talking, because we are all friends, about our families. I think we should never forget the important things and the need to help those who have less than we have.
So, Mr. Director General, you've made it clear I could never have you on this program again, because our job is to scare everybody and to make them worry. And here you are bringing hope and you know, ambition to actually humanize the what we're doing. And so it's just, it's incompatible. But we do try to send our listeners home with a you know, instead of running for the liquor cabinet, maybe they'll actually run to the internet and try to understand more about what you're doing. Let me just say, thank you for making the time, but also for what you're doing at the agency.
No, thank you.
It makes me sleep better at night. So thank you for your time.
It's been great, John, to talk to you. Congratulations on this new endeavor, having someone who has been a practitioner like you in high positions doing this is fantastic, because you have the knowledge of the issues. You know what is at stake. So I will be listening in to your podcast whenever I have an opportunity. So I thank you very, very much.
Okay. Well, I know you're on a lot of planes these days, so it'll put you right to sleep. So thanks so much, Director General Grossi.
Thank you.